We're going to start today with a conversation with Ashim Chandna, who's a partner at Crayla Partners and a veteran venture capitalist whom I have tremendous respect for. Ashim, welcome. It's a superb opportunity to have you here and talk to our entrepreneurs and clarify a lot of misconceptions of venture capital financing. Is your line on unmute? Yes, perfect. So Ashim, we're going to start with some, level setting. You're one of the very few VCs who still practices real venture capital, as in financing concepts for developing significant products, not already revenue-generating businesses, which is where venture capital is slowly moving to or has already moved to. Please share with us a couple of case studies of concept to scale financings that you've done and that have worked out particularly well. And what is your thinking in how you, how you choose to do those things, those kinds of businesses, and what can we learn from it?
Yeah, no, thanks for having me this morning, Samrana. Pleasure to be here. So, yeah, I've been at Greylock about 14 years, and, a significant part of my work there has been, as you mentioned, working with entrepreneurs, from the founding stage. So really from a concept stage where, one has a smart engineer or a smart entrepreneur or a couple of executives that have a product concept, that either targets an existing market or goes after a new market. And, in terms of maybe a couple of quick case studies, my most successful case study, in this area really would be a company called Palo Alto Networks, which got initiated in our office 11 years ago now. And the company today is roughly at about a $2 billion business size, I think 14 or 15, probably $14 billion market cap company. And, generating, many hundreds of millions of free cash flow every year. And the story of that company really is, and to use that as a quick case study, brilliant technologist and entrepreneur and engineer was a friend of mine. His name is Nir Zook. He's the founder of the company. He came by, sat in our office without an idea, and we basically cycled through a bunch of ideas and then, came up with an idea for a, enterprise-grade, integrated, kind of next-generation security product. But I think the key piece here, which, maybe a learning for other entrepreneurs is what we did next is, we actually went and talked to a very significant number of customers. So we kind of, defined a basic product concept, and Nir actually took the rigor of actually writing a data sheet before anything was built, created a few slides, and, then we flew to New York for a week together, talked to a bunch of customers there, talked to many customers in Silicon Valley, and probably talk to 40 or 50 customers before the first significant check was written. So another quick example would be a company called Sumo Logic, which is a privately held company today, and it's several tens of millions of annual recurring revenue, a couple of hundred employees, and similar story, two brilliant engineers, Christian Biedgen and Kumar Saurabh. The idea was, doing cloud-based log management and analytics, which seemed a lot more obvious today than it was, 5 or 6 years ago when this company was started. So similar kind of process, talk to a number of customers and, refine the concept, and then we wrote a check. And then the last one I'll quickly mention is we're involved with a company called Awake Networks, which is today in stealth mode. There's about 35 engineers in the company today. Actually have a board meeting there right after this call this morning. And that company also got initiated in our office a couple of years ago. And, another brilliant entrepreneur, a gentleman called Michael Callahan, second time around we're backing him. And he sat in our office. We came up with a concept, for a next-generation security analytics offering. And, basically Michael, a couple of my colleagues at Greylock, and myself, we talked to about 50 customers. Over a period of multiple months, refined the concept, and then, Greylock wrote, in that case, an $8 million plus check, and we initiated the company. And also along the way, before we initiated the company formally, we helped him find three co-founders to kind of complete the founding team in that case. Yeah. So maybe I'll
so, folks, just to underscore some of the case studies that Ashim has talked about, Palo Alto Networks, you'll find the case study on the blog. Nir Zuk discussed his founding process extensively, and it's amply documented. You can go check it out. Sumo Logic also, we've done the story. This last one, as you said, is stealth, so we haven't gotten to that one yet. But I think the process that you're describing is precisely the process we follow here in 1M1M with all our, you know, enterprise or B2B projects, is this immensely immersive customer discussion and very early on. In fact, I kind of try to tell people, and sometimes they listen, sometimes they don't listen, is not to write a line of code without actually talking to a significant number of customers. There is this, you know, the lean startup movement has created this myth that you need to kind of iterate, prototype, iterate, and I don't think madly iterating without actually talking to customers and getting the specs right is a productive way of doing business. Do you agree with that?
No, I couldn't agree more. In fact, I mean, I would just add, you know, just to that, right, and maybe a little bit of a misconception around, you know, let's say venture capital and Sandhill Road. You know, a lot of entrepreneurs think that they got to hit a significant number of milestones before they can approach, you know, a top-tier venture capital firm or a, you know, prominent venture capitalist. And I would say, you know, nothing could be further from the truth for many, many firms and many individuals. The most important thing is really, I would say, it's the quality of the individual and then the, you know, let's say the significance of the opportunity. And so I think to your point, I would say probably the most important thing an entrepreneur can do is really think through what they're doing and try to, you know, get a understanding of the market opportunity and the reality of it or the lack of the reality of it. And,
yes.
You know, if you can really size the opportunity and understand the pain of the customer and understand who the buyer is and what they might actually pay and think through that and validate that, you know, as much as possible through early conversations, you know, I think to your point, I would argue that that's, you know, 100 times more important than, you know, quickly getting into a room and starting writing code and something that may not be important. And then just to take it further, right, I would say, so we see, you know, we see companies and individuals, you know, where it's one person with an idea, and we'll have a few meetings with that person, you know, or a couple of people, and we'll write a multi-million dollar check, and those people have nothing, no code written. And then, you know, take the other side, you know, companies approach us all the time where there may be a few million in revenue, there may be several tens of employees or even north of 100 employees in the company, and we either won't take the meeting after we see the slide deck or we take one meeting and there'll never be a second meeting, right? So just because, you know, our view is, you know, that particular situation, it doesn't really have the runway, right, that we want, whereas, you know, one person comes in with a good idea and we can see that there could be a very large runway here, and then that would cause us to write the check.
So, but what you're saying is kind of counter to the trends of the venture capital industry right now. It has become the age of lean startups at the seed early stages these days, where entrepreneurs are expected to bootstrap to significant traction, multi-million dollars worth of revenue before they get to Series A. So what you're doing is more the fast startup model where you're putting in money up front and building a product, but you're doing it with a very extensive customer immersion and validation by talking to customers and getting the specs before you write that check. But very few VCs are doing this today. What are your thoughts about how venture capital is evolving?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I would say just, you know, a few quick thoughts. I would say one is, you know, I'm personally a supporter of I consider myself a supporter of entrepreneurs. I'm a supporter of startups. You know, that said, you know, I think most startups are on journeys to nowhere, unfortunately, right? I mean, most people are working very, very hard on things that actually will not materialize, unfortunately. And, you know, many of these folks are better off going into other companies, you know, versus continue to run these journeys. So I think really kind of goes back to, like, you know, most people should really just give additional thought to what they're doing and try to be more strategic about, you know, where do these journeys really go to. I think your question about other VCs and why is the VC industry operating a particular way, You know, there is an oversupply of venture capital. There's a lot of very, very smart people in venture capital. And also probably fair, I'd probably say it's similar to most professions. You know, most people are lazy, right? So most people want everything served up on a plate. The best opportunities don't often, I mean, some of the best opportunities actually do appear that way. But many of them don't as well.
I have a favorite saying: VCs like to come to the rescue of victory these days.
Right, absolutely. Yeah, well, yeah, and everybody wants to. There are many fathers of success as well, right? So yeah.
As we look ahead, the segments where there is a lot of potential are machine learning, cybersecurity, robotics, and many of these are R&D heavy areas and not necessarily that conducive to the lean startup methodology of putting something together and taking it to revenue before you raise any money. How do you advise entrepreneurs to navigate the capital gap given the situation?
Yeah, so it's a great question. I would say, you know, one is it's certainly easier today to build a software or a hardware offering for that matter, than it was even just 3-4 years
sure.
ago, right? I mean, I was looking at somebody else's Twitter feed yesterday, and he had an image there of all the API and other offerings on AWS, and he titled it, you know, the Walmart of app development, right? It's like walking into Walmart, and you can just pick and choose and quickly get going, mm-hmm. right? So it's quite incredible what a young software developer can do today versus a few years ago. That said, I think to your point, yeah, I think products that command a lot of value do take a certain number of engineers. In my experience, you know, if you want to sell to enterprise markets, you know, in order to get a release one product out, you're most likely talking 15 to 25 engineers, you know, probably working for a year to 2 years, you know, maybe a year to year and a half is a sweet spot. So that just takes a certain amount of dollars. And then, you know, if you want to sell something where you can, let's say, you know, command, you know, initial land into a customer of, you know, many tens of thousands of dollars, or ideally, let's say, between $100,000 to $250,000, which is not an easy thing to do, but if you want to kind of build enough value to do that, you probably are talking 15 to 25 engineers working for a year to a year and a half. So that does take a certain amount of dollars up front, and I think that is the reality of the situation. If one was to go back and look at, you know, companies that have gone public and that are publicly traded today, or companies that, let's say, exited for, you know, pick a bar, you know, like north of 150 million or 200 million at some basic bar, one would find that many of those companies, you know, when they built the initial product, they did raise a check of several million dollars. Now, I think one good news for entrepreneurs today is there is an oversupply of money. You know, what used to be a Series A several years ago is considered a seed check today. We see many people come into our office and tell us they're raising a seed check, you know, of $1.5 to $3 million. You know, once you get into the, you know, $2, $3, $4, $5 million range, that's a Series A of several years ago. So the good news is, there's no shortage of money for really smart people who have compelling ideas. But I think it does take a certain amount of dollars if you want to build something, you know, of significance.
There are a few issues with what you said. What you said is, you know, at a 30,000-foot level, true. But when you start actually poking in, peeling the onion and poking in the guts of that statement, there are a lot of issues. One is, if you are looking for somebody to write you a check based on which you're going to develop a concept and that will take some time before you will see traction, people are looking for serial entrepreneurs, repeat entrepreneurs. They're looking to see, you know, track record. And that's, you know, first-time entrepreneur's life is very, very difficult in that sense.
No, I would say yes and no. I would say certainly if one is a repeat entrepreneur, you know, one has the credibility to your point, and you're going to quickly get meetings, right? I mean, if there's somebody got a success behind them, they email a bunch of VCs, even if it's not through a warm introduction, they likely get the meeting very quickly. But, you know, we fund, I mean, the majority of the work we do is we're funding first-time entrepreneurs. And I'll give you an example of a couple of guys who were in our office last week. You know, two young guys, you know, one of them was ex-Facebook, the other gentleman, I think he was ex-Google, so this, again, might be a little bit of an extreme case. But, you know, first meeting, very smart guys, you know, working on some new stuff in AI. We chose not to do it in this particular case, but, you know, within 5 business days, they were funded by somebody else, $2 million check, another very prominent VC, and they told us when they were in office last week, you know, just literally from day first start, moving very quickly. I'll give you an example of another one where we did do it, you know, where first-time entrepreneurs, this is a company called Instart Logic, very interesting company, you know, I think very highly of the team there. We were fortunate, you know, we got introduced to some very young engineers several years ago now, took a meeting. On the spot, we committed $500,000 to them, literally. And I feel so fortunate we did that, you know. They were, you know, some very bright people. The primary founder is a young Indian engineer called Manav Mittal. He's turned out to be a superb CEO. He's got a rapidly growing company. But I just use that example. So we, you know, I'd say, yeah, I mean, we see, we're just looking for the caliber of the person. We're looking for the precision of that thought. You know, the other thing I've found is many of the very best people, they can be very, very precise in their thinking, both in the way they write. And so it's one of the things I do look for when people email me ahead. I typically will request an executive summary or PowerPoint, and I just look for the precision in which they're communicating. And then, you know, when they come into the meeting, if they can communicate precisely and if their worldview is fair and rational, you have many very smart people who don't have any rational worldviews, and then in that case, we may not want to fund them. But, yeah, but I would say actually, you know, I think it's true for us. I actually think it's true for many other VCs where, you know, you don't have to be a repeat entrepreneur, but you do have to be, let's say, at the top of your game, right? So you could be a 22-year-old.
But as domain expertise, right, I think what you and many other VCs are absolutely, that precision comes from very deep domain knowledge, especially when you're trying to do something that is technically deep and heuristically deep. It has to be coming out of something that is that has very deep domain knowledge, and that's really what I see people looking for. You know, I was talking to a guy last week. I did the story. It hasn't been published yet. It's a company called Leo Software. And this guy had a very deep understanding of tax regulation that was new. So about, you know, 7-8 years ago, he put together a company, and the first customer that he went to was Brocade. And that's a sizable customer that was willing to write a $300,000 check for this product. So he kind of sold the concept to the customer, got the customer to pay for it and build the product, and then every single customer he sold to, I think the first customer he sold for deep discount, but he, you know, got the understanding of the product and so forth, and the second, third customer onward started selling at $300,000, and very deep domain knowledge, and it allowed him to bootstrap this company, because if you have something that is that high gross margin, right? And that solves a very sharp pain point. You can do something for relatively cheap from a financing point of view. So again, it speaks to your domain knowledge question. Whether you're, you know, self-financing or doing it with seed financing or shooting for venture capital, I think it's that precision and domain knowledge that's really what wins eventually.
That's right. I think the other piece also in your example is just, I think, you know, people, you want people on the technical side, you can also get out there and talk to customers and have that hustle and have that ability to kind of, you know, take, you know, not be deterred by a no and keep going and do whatever it takes to kind of get those early customers.
Yeah. You know, one method that we are seeing a lot of first-time entrepreneurs in particular using to successfully manage that capital gap in early-stage fast startups is bootstrapping using services. So they would do contract software development, achieve that level of customer intimacy, really get to understand the problem, develop the domain knowledge, and then bootstrap a product company based on services revenues and that customer understanding. How do you view this method?
Yeah, that's a great question as well. I would say that, you know, I'd say time is nobody's friend, right? So basically, if I'm a young, or if I'm an entrepreneur and I basically, you know, have an idea, and I think the idea is significant for a software offering, right? Probably the best thing I can do for myself is get going with that as quickly as possible, right? And any time I spend, any of my work time I spend, not focused on that, if that opportunity is real, somebody else is going to run and capitalize on that. So what I should really do is I should really kind of quickly get going with that as quickly as possible. Now, I think there could be a couple of reasons to go down the path you mentioned. You know, one is if I can't raise the financing I need to go build that product.
Which is the truth for the majority of the first-time entrepreneurs. You know, you have the privilege of sitting there and picking and choosing who we want to invest in, but if you look at the bulk of the entrepreneur community, they don't have that privilege.
So then I think, yeah, absolutely. I think being, you know, entrepreneurial and saying, okay, I'm going to run the services business, the consulting business, use the cash flow from that to kind of fund my software offering, I think that's kind of very viable. But I would say the moment you get to a basic bootstrap at the next level, where you've got enough evidence behind your software offering that you can go raise the financing you need to kind of, you know, focus on that software offering, you should get to that as quickly as possible. I think the other reason to kind of go down that path is, you know, different people have different views on dilution and ownership, right? And I think some people take a point of view like, hey, even if I go slower, even if I have a lower market share, whatever, I just want to own the whole business. And, hey, there are many ways to kind of come at this. And so certainly one is a point of view that we want to own the business completely ourselves. And that could be a path to somebody, you know, owning that completely themselves.
Well, I think there are, you know, the way we look at, we actually do a lot of work with bootstrapped entrepreneurs, partly because, you know, we are working with, our mission is to help as many entrepreneurs be successful as possible. And I can tell you the vast majority of these entrepreneurs should not be raising money because they just don't have the TAM to do a VC-funded company. And the truth is there are lots of niches where you can build a $5, $10 million company, but you cannot build a $100, $200 million company, and that's fine. It's just that you shouldn't waste your time chasing VCs in those situations. But on the dilution point, I guess the thing that is very concerning is there is a lot of hanky-panky in term sheets in the venture world.
Right.
So you could work 6-7 years and get nothing, even if your company is acquired for, let's say, $200 million because you're up to your neck in liquidation preferences. And a lot of first-time entrepreneurs don't really understand the concept. They're carried away by these very hefty valuations and so on and so forth. So your point is well taken that, you know, that you shouldn't be worried about ownership and so forth, but I would counter that by saying you should actually pay attention to what you're doing and where your negotiating privilege, you know, or your negotiating position lies. Again, I have another favorite saying, which is do not go to VCs as beggars, go as kings.
Absolutely,
so that you
yeah.
do have some negotiating position.
Yeah, no, actually, but I'll just add to that and say, you know, I think we at Greylock and I personally, we want to be in business with entrepreneurs that are dilution sensitive. We want to be in business with entrepreneurs that, you know, respect the value of equity and, you know, and are very discerning about it, right? Because we want to be in business with people that want to grow the value, want to grow shareholder value. And I also would say that, you know, I personally and, you know, Greylock and, you know, I'd say many of the best VCs, we're actually not fans of complex term sheets or of complex structure. And, you know, generally, I mean, when we provide term sheets, the term sheets are extremely clean. Now, I think a couple of things I would say is that basically, you know, many entrepreneurs and I would say the venture press in particular or even the business press tends to focus on the amount of capital a company raises and looks at that as a strength of a business. And I also see many entrepreneurs' resumes, and the resumes begin with how much venture capital they raise. And it's all wrong, right? Because many of the best businesses are actually built, or the very best businesses are actually built in very capital-efficient ways. And, you know, and venture capital is nothing more than an artificial crutch in many cases. And so people have a false sense of security when they raise a lot of money. And the way you get yourself into trouble is if you, you know, raise a lot of money and you're not doing good primary work, and then, you know, you get quite frankly screwed by the preference table, right, or by the preference stack. So yeah, so I think if I was an entrepreneur, I would take the money, but then I would want to be very, very focused on the milestones I want to deliver, and I'd use my money very, very carefully.
And you bring up media. I think media is both ignorance and, as a result, extremely confusing for entrepreneurs, because look at this last 2 years' obsession with unicorns. You know, what is a unicorn? You can get a unicorn without any primary milestone delivery with stacks of liquidation preferences, and you get a unicorn.
Right, exactly.
And entrepreneurs are getting obsessed. Oh, I am running a unicorn because I got this valuation, and so what?
Yeah, and I think this is where, you know, I think there's many, many very smart people at venture-backed companies, and the average employee at a venture-backed company, I think, is pretty smart. But I think people are also very naive, right? They focus on a lot of the wrong things. What they should really be focusing is on just more of the primary factors in terms of, you know, as you mentioned, the total available market for an offering, what's the strength of the offering, you know, what's really going on in sales productivity, you know, fundamentally, what's the quality of the people in the company, you know, because if there's really...
customers. I mean, the bottom line is customers, revenues, profits. That's how you build fundamentals.
Yeah, exactly.
So last question, Ashim, what is your, you know, like you are talking to various kinds of customers all the time and you're seeing all kinds of things. What are some areas where you're looking to invest today?
Yeah, so I would say, you know, we're clearly in, you know, what many would call kind of, you know, the mobile cloud era. You know, the front end is going to mobile, the back end is going to cloud. That back-end cloud might be, you know, on public cloud, the back-end cloud might be, you know, behind the firewall, right? And you know, what many people would say is that we're in a hybrid world, and we're going to continue to be in a hybrid world for many years with increasing kind of, let's say, push or pull onto, you know, onto more of the public cloud, right?
Mm-hmm.
That backdrop, right, that's kind of what's going on broadly on the enterprise side. On the consumer side, you know, we're going towards, you know, a multi-billion-dollar audience, you know, or we're an early multi-billion. We're going into many billions of basically audience having smartphones, right? So it's a very, very interesting time. And so I'd say with that backdrop, right, we're looking for entrepreneurs, you know, on the consumer side that can reach very large audiences, you know, very, very quickly with new concepts. And then on the enterprise side, right, looking for, I'd say, primarily subscription-based businesses that can live in that mobile cloud era, right, that can thrive in that mobile cloud era. So there's opportunities, you know, to reinvent the infrastructure stack. There's opportunities for new applications, you know, and then, yeah.
All right. Well, thank you for coming. It was very interesting listening to you, and it's a rare treat to talk to somebody who actually still practices real venture capital. So thanks for taking the time.
So thanks very much for having me, Smarana. Yeah.